and welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me is my good friend, Chris Haig. How are you doing, Chris?
I am really good. How are you doing?
I am sweltering. It is really, really hot here today. It's well over 30 degrees Celsius. Do you guys use Celsius over there?
Yeah. It's weird. Everyone presumes it's like, oh, it's a Fahrenheit thing. No, we're Celsius over here, so we're the same as you.
Yeah, so it's well over 30 Celsius. Well, not well over. It's probably 31 or something like that, but it's pretty hot. I don't have air conditioning in my car, so.
Oh, my God.
So my windows roll down. But I've discovered an awesome way. So I have to drive like 5 minutes on the highway to get from my job. And if you keep the driver's side window and the back driver's side window closed.
Yeah.
And lower the passenger side front and back, it creates an awesome tunnel of air. Better than if you do it the opposite. Like, most people drive with the driver's window down, yeah. Right? Well, if you do it the opposite, it creates an awesome tunnel of air. And it just, it is flowing. It's great.
I love that. So if you take nothing else away from today's show, please try it out the next time you're in a heat wave.
Yes, do the opposite windows. Most people want to put the driver's window down because that's where you are. Do the opposite side.
Oh.
But you got to do both because that's what creates the cycling. Anyways, we're not here to talk about the weather in Saskatchewan. Tom will be joining us shortly. He was unable to make it today. He's on the road himself, but he probably has air conditioning. him, and we have a special guest named Pat McFadden, who's a very good friend of the show, will be joining us in a little while to give their thoughts on the play for this, because they actually read the play for the Skin Game as well. They did way above and beyond the Call of Duty on the show today. And they will also give a few of their thoughts on a few other Hitchcock topics as well. But before we jump into our show, we're recording this on the 22nd of June. It'll be released early July. But we have an awesome new thing available. We've got T-shirts and shirts available. If you go to TeePublic, you can search for Good Evening and you can find some shirts. So you can wear your murderous love. You know what the best part about this is, Chris, that I was looking around?
Yeah.
They've got onesies.
No, they don't.
They
do.
I don't know if they have onesies that would fit you or me. But they have onesies. And I could just see somebody with a baby and a shirt that says Good Evening, and there's a large butcher knife on our new logo, right? Like, I can't wait for somebody to tweet at us their baby with the onesie that says Good Evening.
Yeah. Oh, please do. That'd be awesome. I mean, I've shopped with TeePublic I bought some shirts over the past couple of years and everything. They are great quality. They're very soft. They come in like a ton of designs, so while you're picking up ours, you can pick up some other stuff. They have a lot of funny ones. They also do like sweatshirts and mugs and all kinds of stuff. So, and I will say, I love... We had a previous run of... Good Evening t-shirts, which are awesome, but this one is even better. It's our full logo. It's, you know, the Fandom Podcast Network. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. So please seriously check them out, guys. They are rather fab, if we do say so ourselves.
Yeah, they got totes and pillows and mugs and notebooks and phone cases and laptop cases.
Everything you could stick our logo on. They've got it.
You got it. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. So definitely check it out. And we would be thrilled to have somebody tweet or Facebook message us with themselves wearing it, or even their infant.
Yeah. you get bonus points if it's your infant, if you buy like a little infant onesie, or even buy a regular t-shirt and put your baby in that. So it's like for them to grow into.
If you send us a photo
of that, I may, you know, I don't know, send you like cookies or something. I don't know. It'd be awesome.
I gotta email them though, because I'm disappointed that they don't have a onesie for a 6'6", 375-pound man. Because I would totally buy one.
You can get them. I am the proud owner of a onesie. You can get them. Believe me. But yeah, I don't think you'll be able to get it with our logo. Unfortunately, like we've said, you can get, you know, t-shirts and everything else. So yeah, definitely check them out.
Excellent. Well, I will be reading here shortly our our little behind the scenes information on it, and then I will cut to Tom, and Tom and Pat will talk to you guys for a bit, and then we will do a recap summary with Chris. I've just put Chris on the spot.
Okay,
have to recap this movie.
Sorry, I got it. I'm good.
Well, so The Skin Game is based on a play by John Galsworthy. It was first performed at the St. Martin's Theatre, London, in 1920, and made its way to the Bijou Theatre, Broadway, the same year. It was included in Burns Mantle's The Best Plays of 1920 and 1921. It's been made into a film twice, in 1921 and in 1931, which the 31 version is the Hitchcock version. Wikipedia lists the release date as February 26th, 1931, and it's 88 minutes long. Now, there is really not a lot of information that I was able to find on the behind the scenes for this. Wikipedia didn't list anything. The Hitchcock Zone had coming soon, like even on this page. And the two books that I have, there was one line in the complete films, Alfred Hitchcock, the complete films by Paul Duncan, and there was one paragraph in The Art of Alfred Hitchcock by Donald Spotto. Not much information is known, not much information is given. So the best I'm going to be able to do for you guys today is on a couple of the actors. So Edmund Gwenn was an English actor, and he played Mr. Hornblower. On film, he's perhaps best remembered for his role as Kris Kringle in the Christmas film Miracle on 34th Street from 1947, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor and the corresponding Golden Globe Award. He received a second Golden Globe and another Academy Award nomination for the comedy film Mr. 880 from 1950. He's also remembered for being in four films by Hitchcock, and we will see him again in Waltzes from Vienna, Foreign Correspondent, and The Trouble with Harry. As a stage actor in the West End and on Broadway, he was associated with a wide range of works by modern playwrights, including Bernard Shaw, John Galsworthy, and J.B. Priestley. After the Second World War, he lived in the United States, where he had a successful career in Hollywood and on Broadway. Now, the interesting thing about Edmund Gwenn playing this role is he actually also played Mr. Hornblower in the 1921 version of the film. So he played the same character in both films, which I think is very interesting. And we find that about Helen Hay as well. So Helen Hay played Ivy Hillcrest, and she also played Mrs. Hillcrest in the 1921 version of the film. So I think that's kind of strange that they did that. But Helen Hay was a British stage and film actress, and she began acting on the stage in 1898, and she debuted in London in 1911 as Gertrude in Hamlet. Her film career began in 1917, and she often worked with director Alexander Korda. She made her final film appearance in Laurence Olivier's Richard III as Duchess of York in 1955. We will see her again in The 39 Steps. Charles Vernon France played Jack Hillcrest, and he's usually credited as C.V. France. He was a British actor. France appeared in William Somerset Maugham's, I hope I'm saying that right, Maugham's, M-A-U-G-H-A-M.
do you want me just to tell you?
Yes.
It's Maugham.
Maugham.
No, Maugham as in to mourn something.
Mourn.
Yeah, Maugham.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's no R, though.
It's just how it's pronounced. In the UK, never presume something is pronounced the way it's spelt.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so William Somerset Maugham, his 1932 play For Services Rendered, a play in three acts. And he also appeared in Maurice Baring's 1912 drama The Grey Stocking, a play in four acts. France's stage acting was singled out for praise in Maugham's 1938 literary memoir, The Summing Up. And Maugham had this to say: "But there's one actor whom, since he has never reached the rank of a star and has so hardly received the recognition that he deserves, I should like to mention. This is C.V. France. He has acted in several of my plays. He has never played a part in which he has not been admirable. He has represented, to the smallest particular, the character that I had in my mind's eye. It would be difficult to find on the English stage a more competent, intelligent, and versatile actor. This will be his only Hitchcock appearance." And lastly, we'll talk about Phyllis Constom, who played Chloe. She was an English film actress born in London and was in 11 films between 28 and 64, including 4 films by Hitchcock. She married the tennis star Bunny Austin in 1931, whom she met on a cruise liner while traveling to the U.S. to appear in a stage production of Frank Vosper's Murder on the Second Floor, opposite her close friend Laurence Olivier. Together, Austin and Constum were one of the celebrity couples of the age. Austin played tennis with Charlie Chaplin, was a friend of Daphne du Maurier, and met both Queen Mary and President Franklin D. Roosevelt. They had 2 children. In her later years, she joined her husband with involvement in the Oxford Group, performing in several films and theatrical productions around the world to benefit the cause. She died from a heart attack in Somerset on August 20th, 1976, which was her husband's 70th birthday. And that's all the behind-the-scenes information I have for you guys today. So let's jump to Tom and Pat and hear what they have to say.
Thank you, Brandon and Chris. And this is Tom Caldwell. Happy to be with you for this episode of Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. We're talking about The Skin Game. And we're very happy to have a special guest with us today. Pat McFadden describes himself as a Hitchaholic. He's had over 40 years seeing and studying the films of the master. He has a film degree from Emerson College, which, as he said, gave him the courage to leave New York and move to Hollywood, where he worked as an assistant editor for 8 disillusioning years. And for the past 20 years, he's had a much steadier work as an executive assistant at Walt Disney Imagineering. The internet has enabled him to reach out and discuss Hitchcock with rabid fans and established authors. And for the last 4 years, Pat has been an assistant to Joel Guns, who is the Alfred Hitchcock Geek, moderating discussions on the Alfred Hitchcock Geek Facebook page. Welcome to Good Evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
We're very excited to have you on the show. You're a very serious fan of Hitchcock. How did you come across the Good Evening podcast?
Well, I have a daily Hitchcock news feed summary email. I believe it was just found, mentioned in some article somewhere. I was on a train. I think the first one I listened to was Downhill.
Okay.
And then I went back and listened to the ones before that and tried to remember to tune in each month. I like it a lot. It's really interesting to me to hear people's takes on Hitchcock when they see the films for the first time.
Well, we do appreciate your support. You've been very helpful, sort of a friend of the show, helping us get hold of copies of films that are hard to find and giving us content ideas. So quickly, before we get too far, tell me your story about your how you celebrated your 50th birthday with Hitchcock.
Oh, well, it just so happened that the day after my 50th birthday, the Hitchcock 9, the 9 silent films that British International Pictures restored, made their premiere showing engagement in San Francisco all in one weekend. It was Blackmail on Friday night, and then 4 of the films on Saturday and 4 of the films on Sunday. In the classic Castro Theater. So two friends of mine and I went, and along the way we stopped at the Mission from Vertigo and took that in. And then when we weren't sitting in the theater watching the films on the weekend, we were hunting down every existing Hitchcock location in the city that we could find. And
right on.
Some of the ones that aren't there anymore, we went to where they used to be, so total geekdom.
Right on. Good for you. You're very dedicated to the cause. So we're talking about Skin Game. And I think you and I were planning to focus more comparing the film to the play. So the play is by the British playwright and novelist John Galsworthy, who lived from 1867 to 1931. He actually won a Nobel Prize in Literature in 1932, and he's a very accomplished playwright, and this was adapted from his play. And so we have both read the play. Mm-hmm. So we've read the play on paper. We've read the script of the play, which is much different than seeing a version of the play. So we should clarify that we're comparing the film to having read the text of the play. So what was your impression that when you are reading the play itself as a document?
Well, after having seen the film a few times and then reading the play, my first impression was, well, overall, it's pretty faithful to the play, but my first impression was the first act of the play is quite different from the first reel or two of the film. Some things are left out. They're not really missed. What Hitch did was sort of chop up and move things around so that he could widen it out some. And I don't think it was that successful. And one of the reasons I recommend reading at least Act One of the play is that the movie opens in a sort of choppy way, as though it had been quickly re-edited. And I think the start of the movie could have been a lot better. But otherwise, the play is very well written. It's quite long, like the movie seems to be. What fascinates me about this play, well, okay, I have to go into Hitchcock and his adaptation of plays in general, because he made about 10 films that were adapted from plays or based on plays. There were three Silence, Easy Virtue, The Farmer's Wife, and Blackmail. That doesn't count so much because without the sound, you have to change it radically to fit the silent screen idiom. But then the first two sound plays, not counting Blackmail, but the first two sound plays that he adapted were Juno and the Paycock and The Skin Game. You've discussed Juno and the Paycock before, and that's one of my least favorite Hitchcocks. It's pretty hard to get through.
Yeah.
And it was very static, very stagey. He pretty much just let the camera sit and people act in front of it. And he was embarrassed that it was a success because he didn't think that he had done a good job on that at all. But The Skin Game was assigned to him by British International Pictures. He wasn't really interested in it. And so he covered it pretty much the same way, but better. Then as he goes along in his career, you've got Rope, Under Capricorn, I Confess. And finally, his best adaptation of a play is his last one, Dial M for Murder. But we're months before talking about that.
Yeah, for sure. As is typical, like some of the other films you mentioned that were plays originally, this film really comes across like a play done on film.
Yes.
It's pretty straightforward. There's, only a few locations involved. And it's that style, you mentioned Rope. It's the style that I always bring back to comparing to Rope, where the scenes are really long. They're doing long conversations. They're portraying it like they are actors on a stage, as opposed to the way we're used to in film with lots of short dialogue cutting back and forth. There's a lot of long conversations happening, a lot of long camera takes, and that's good. That's comfortable to watch. People of the era would have been very accustomed to watching that. But in the same time, there are some pretty jazzy camera segments happening. Like during the auction house scene, there's a lot of fast camera work going back and forth, trying to portray that energy, that action in the auction house. This bid, that bid, back and forth, back and forth. And that's pretty innovative for the time, considering, again, you know, the camera equipment was pretty bulky and big and heavy, and they were, he was already pushing himself creatively. But I found that, yeah, like in general, it does come across like a play done on film.
Yes.
Which isn't a bad thing.
And something I haven't figured out, and I haven't seen anyone write about so far, of course there are, you know, so many books, he did this odd thing. It wasn't just that he put the camera down and let people act in front of it. He would have the camera on two people, say, in a scene. Then one would walk out of the shot. But the camera stayed there, and you would hear the other person talking, but you would be still looking at this other character. And the only thing I can think that he might have meant by that was he was always interested in trying to recreate the theatrical experience on film. When you're watching a film through opera glasses, you know, or just without, you're usually concentrating on one character. You can't be watching everyone at once. So perhaps that was in his mind, but I don't think it was very successful.
There are a number of times in the film where dialogue is happening off camera, and we're looking at a character that's in another room listening to the dialogue happen.
Yeah.
And which is inventive. That's creative. Like, it's off the beaten path a little bit, and it's interesting to see. So he is he's already being very innovative with the camera placement and the cinematography, I guess, in general.
Yeah.
One thing, you mentioned Juno and the Peacock. When I was reading the play, which I read the play before watching the film, when I was reading the play, I was imagining what these accents were going to come across like on the screen. And they were very easy to hear. Like, the accents were almost non-existent in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I was dreading that heavy, heavy accent that we had to tolerate in Juno and the Peacock. But the accents were very approachable. It was very plain English. That made it very easy to watch in that regard.
Yes. But with the sound on the prints of that film, it is better if you've read it, because just some of the dialogue is difficult to hear even under the best circumstances. But back to the skin game, you're right, the auction scene is really the money scene. I think it's the one that he had the most enthusiasm for. And not only is the camera doing that magnificent flashing back and forth, I really don't know how that was done so easily at that time. But also you've got something else going on, just visually, which is Chloe seeing across the room this man who she knows can expose her shameful past and basically destroy her and her family's life. And she almost faints at the sight of him. When she looks again, he does an effect where the man's face keeps floating at her. And he would do that again in Rich and Strange to comedic effect. But you can always see in these early films that he is trying things out, even when he doesn't like the material. Like, when you're bored, you doodle. And I think...
Yeah, right.
I think...
That's a good analogy.
And I think that, you know, he was trying out certain things.
Oh, for sure.
Also in the auction, there's the man who reads out the description of, I don't know what it was, the auction's rules or the description of the property.
It's like a caveat. It's like the details of the deed of the purchase of the property.
Right. But you can't hear him. He is mumbling, and people are saying, speak out. And that happens again in the 39 Steps much more successfully.
Well, and I think in the play, in the written play, it talks about this man speaking quietly and you can't really hear him. And then why does the auctioneer have to be coughing? You know what I mean? Like, the auctioneer takes these horrible cough breaks while he's speaking.
Yeah.
And is that just trying to be realistic? Is that just trying to be adding character to that auctioneer? Like, what's the meaning behind that?
You got me. I really don't know. And I wish more was written about this. It's just passed right by in the Truffaut book. Hitchcock has no interest in talking about it. And
this is one of those early films he was forced to make, and he didn't really have much interest in talking about it later.
Right. But once it gets going, once you get past the auction scene and you see the rivalry and what the wife is planning to do with poor Chloe as the pawn, it draws the person in, it draws the viewer in much more. And I think it's compelling. I mean, it's got its moments of antiquated shocks, like she was someone who would get a man his divorce, you know, and divorce is nothing today. You're nothing if you haven't divorced.
They were very coy about explaining, but basically she was a prostitute, and she would be set up with these men in hotels to give them a reason to be divorced.
Yeah.
I didn't quite catch how they were going about that, but well, it was a very shameful secret that she was holding.
It's the same thing is covered in Easy Virtue. Apparently, if you get a divorce in that era, you had to have a co-respondent. You had to have someone who wrecked the marriage. I don't understand the ins and outs of that. I'd like to read up more about that. But, divorce was shameful in society, and I think that was the reason.
We're gonna not take too much longer here. This has been a sort of a brief discussion of the play and the film as part of the larger episode of Good Evening. And, as we wrap up here, do you have a rating that you'd like to assign to the film?
I'd like to give it 2 out of 5 chopped down trees.
They did some amazing work for men with an axe when they fell that was a big tree that they fell at the end of there. And that was just brawn manpower.
Yeah.
Good for them.
And it comes out of nowhere. That ending is so abrupt.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Pat, I do appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
As I said earlier, we appreciate your support, and we look forward to talking with you again down the road on some other films. And as we wrap up our little segment here, we're going to just hand everything back over to Brandon, Shay, and to Chris.
All right, but before I go, I would like to put in a plug for AlfredHitchcockGeek.com. Joel Guns is the Alfred Hitchcock Geek, and it was through that I was able to communicate with you to begin with, actually.
Right.
There's a detailed website with a lot of heavy reading, and the Facebook page, which is just a lot of fun for discussions. And also, Joel has started this new web series it's kind of interesting. He's trying to raise money for it through some crowdsourcing. You can subscribe for as little as $2 a month, and you'd be helping to create these videos and also getting some content for it. So I recommend that people go to either the Facebook page of HitchcockGeek.com or the website.
For sure. I've been following that new project, and I think that's very interesting. And I definitely recommend that our viewers, our listeners, take the time to visit your various social media and your website and check that out.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate you taking the time to record a little spot for us today. Thank you so much, Pat, for joining us. It's wonderful, and we'll get you on again when all four of us can talk together at one time. Now, Chris.
Yes.
Can you give us a summary of the movie?
Yep, I will give us a very quick summary, because I dare say Tom and Pat have already talked a lot about the film. So, in case you've not seen The Skim Game, it's a 1931 film directed by Hitchcock that concerns a feud between two affluent families. So you have the long-established and upper-classed Hillcrists, who are kind of the quintessential posh, money, descended from money, aristocratic types. And then you have what is called the nouveau riche. So these are formerly working class who have, you know, through business or enterprise have entered upper class in that sense, and these are the hornblowers. The film is effectively a kind of theme about class warfare and urbanization of the countryside. The two families, you know, fighting over pieces of land that Mr. Hornblower keeps buying up. After the Hillcrests are tricked into losing it, they discover a dark secret about Mr. Hornblower's daughter-in-law, Chloe, and so they start to blackmail the Hornblowers in order to kind of keep the land, keep the deed and all that sort of thing. Unfortunately, it all spirals out of control, and it plays almost a bit like a it's almost a bit like a kind of screwball comedy in the sense of there's people hiding behind curtains and there's, you know, secrets and lies and people making stuff up. And unfortunately, it all ends in tragedy when the daughter-in-law, completely despondent and wanting to keep, you know, her secret a secret, decides to drown herself and leaving everyone pretty much devastated and broken. And yeah, that is, yeah, it's a very informal summary, but it's kind of a interesting sort of film.
And everybody lived happily. Oh no, they didn't.
No, nobody lived, and nobody lived happily ever after if they did. I have some feelings about this film. So
early Hitchcock is depressing.
I know. I mean, I don't know if it was like, oh, as he kind of went into Hollywood, they kind of started enforcing more happy endings or more.
They gave him Prozac.
Well, maybe. Maybe they just gave him
part
a lot
of his contract.
Maybe. Maybe they just gave him a load of like SSRIs and antidepressants and stuff and were like, here, it's fine. You know, write something where not everybody dies and you don't like kill off, you know, people unfairly. I think it's an interesting one. And as I said, Tom and Pat have spoken about this, which is if you compare the way that the film ends, the 1931 version, because I haven't seen the 21, so I can't compare, but the 31 version compared to the actual play, because if I'm right, the play ends much more upbeat in that Chloe, she's pulled out of the pond. She decides to drown herself in the family pond, but she's pulled out alive.
Yeah, she's not alive in the movie at the end.
No, well,
at least I didn't get the impression. Because the interesting thing is in this book by Donald Spotto, he says, I was going to question that.
Mm.
And here he says, during the conflicts between the aristocratic landowner Mr. Hillcrist and the nouveau riche Mr. Hornblower, mm-hmm. the younger generation, supposedly the love interest, is drawn into the strife, and only an attempted suicide in a mansion's reflecting pool livens things up for a few moments. And I'm like, attempted? I was certain she was dead when I was watching the movie.
I was going to say, I rewatched the ending just before we recorded, and I was just looking, and I was like, they're definitely hinting that she's dead, because there's no, you know, oh, let's get her to the hospital, let's all that sort of thing. And Mr. Oh my God, I'm finding it so hard to keep a track of the names. Mr. Hornblower, in his final kind of angry speech, goes, well, you've destroyed my family, you've killed my grandchild.
Yeah, because
which
she was
I
pregnant.
Can only take to mean, like, well, if they know the baby's dead, I'm going to guess it's because they know the mother's dead.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, because they did say that. I remember that. And that's interesting because, yeah, you got a baby dying in films in the 1930s. Like, whoa, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah. But they set it up. And I think this is unfair. Poor Chloe. She didn't technically do anything wrong. You know, by our standards, yes, her big secret was that she was, and I think this is quite an interesting job, is that she was basically a professional, like, other woman. So when it was, like, divorce cases, she would testify saying, yes, he, you know, adulterated with me and all that sort of thing, without actually having done it. And so it was just kind of, it's, I think it is tipping to that kind of morality thing that has been reinforced a bit, which is that the women who don't fit neatly into the molds, or who, you know, they're effectively being punished, and that seems,
yep.
I think that's the reason why Chloe had to die at the end. It's that, you know, oh, you know, even though, you know, I certainly felt sympathetic towards it, a lot of the characters I thought were just the most terrible snobs I've ever met in my entire life, but I sort of felt sorry for her. Sorry, go on.
The thing about these Hitchcock films with these rich families and stuff, like, all this makes me want to do is not be rich.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. I mean, it's a whole social class thing. It reminds me of, there is a play by J.B. Priestley called An Inspector Calls. You might have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. I have not, no.
I know. Okay, it's good. If you have a chance, check it out. And it's basically about a young woman commits suicide, and a very rich, a kind of nouveau riche family is visited by an inspector who questions each member of the family, and it turns out that each member had a direct or indirect role in causing her suicide. So it was like the father got her sacked from her job because he owned the factory. You know, the daughter did this, the daughter's fiancé did this, and that sort of thing. And it's basically a big kind of moral story about your responsibilities and kind of privilege, and saying if you've got the money and you've got the power, you need to use it wisely. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And it really reminded me a lot watching this, because I know that obviously Skin Game was originally a play, and you, at least for me, you definitely get the sense that it was originally a play in the way that it's of not necessarily just how it's shot, but kind of how it's staged and how the dialogue works, and you can tell it's like, oh yeah, no, this is something about it. But yeah, I think that's why Chloe had to die, and I don't know if that was a censorship thing or if it was like Hitchcock's kind of stylistic choice to be like, well, there needs to be karmic retribution, which I'm fine with. I'm fine with natural justice, but then you're essentially killing an innocent woman who hasn't really done anything, and an unborn child, and destroyed two families. Yeah. You know,
that's what's even crazier is the unborn child. Yeah. Like, that just blew my mind.
I'm gonna say, I wonder if that's to actually, like, the little sting in the tail. If they always knew they were gonna kill Chloe off, and then they put the bit in about her being, you know, however many weeks pregnant or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that when it did happen, you'd be like, okay, so it's not just the guilty woman, in quotation marks, killing herself. It's also her unborn child. And so it adds extra devastation to Mr. Hornblower, mm-hmm, and his wife that, oh yeah, it's the tragedy of this, you know, they've lost their grandchild.
Yeah.
You know. And it's at both of them, because you've got the very snooty, you know, the Hillcrests who are like, oh, yeah, you know, almost like divine right. We've had this land and this money and this position and privilege for centuries, or for, you know, generations, and no one's going to take it away from us. And then the nouveau riche are stealing up bits of land as well. So I think it's a bit of a satire on both, and kind of if you don't show respect, or if you don't kind of take other people into consideration, what happens? Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah.
Now, I want to get back to some of the plot elements, so remind me so I don't forget about Mr. Hornblower and what he's doing with this property.
Yes.
But I want to go back to something you said about Chloe and her job, because I find it weird that they wrote it this way, and this is probably a censorship issue, because in the movie, her previous job and the scandalous information that they have on her is that... Yeah, so when somebody wanted to get divorced, you had to have a reason.
Yes, yeah.
And if you didn't have a reason, they paid her to sleep with them so that she could be called the other woman. So now the man has a reason to get divorced. The woman can divorce the husband because he's been cheating on her.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, was divorce that common that this is a full-time job where she's like, my full-time job is splitting people up? That's what they pay me to do, is to divorce people. So, in my opinion, they couldn't maybe call her that? She's a prostitute.
Well.
Like, maybe they just couldn't call her that, right?
Maybe. I mean, you know, she has the same job effectively in the play, but even at that time, they wouldn't have got away with, like, oh, you know, the big scandal is, you know, your son married, you know, a sex worker or a prostitute. And it's like, well, yeah, they probably couldn't have got away with that. So, yeah,
So why have that added bizarre layer of my job is splitting people up and giving people a reason to divorce?
I mean, it could be the whole idea. If for at least from the film's perspective, is, oh, here is, you know, her... And it's the whole idea of being an adulteress and sleeping with other people's husbands and all that sort of thing. So it could be that, to reinforce the idea that, you know... That she, she's wicked, she's sinful, so what happens to her is almost justified. It could easily be that, because otherwise, you know, she's killing herself over a secret that makes no sense to worry about it getting out, so...
Well, yeah, she didn't kill herself over the secret. She killed herself because of what she heard her husband saying about her.
True, but it's because of the secret that... Because he was convinced, oh, you know, there's something going on, and he was convinced she was cheating on him, which is ironic because she spent her career being the other person, mm-hmm. and now it's someone else accusing her of cheating, and that's her downfall. I think because she's seen the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. And when Mrs. Hillcrist there was explaining the job, like, you know, she was laying it out and describing what it was. And so as she was describing it, I thought this was going to be an instance like an Easy Virtue where, oh, she's been divorced once before. Oh, what a scandal. Mm. Right. But no, they're like, so she's explaining it point by point to Mr. Hornblower. And she's like, yeah, you know, divorce. He's like, well, I don't know divorce because I know what it is.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, well, so you know when you need a reason to be divorced, right? You know, and cheating. I'm like, oh, so she cheated on her previous. No, she was paid to be the cheater. And I was like, oh, okay. So I thought this was going to be another instance of Easy Virtue where that's all the scandal was. But it turned out to be quite a bit more than that. A weirdness scale anyways. So
no, I mean, it's quite a, it's an interesting take on it, if nothing else. I've never really. There might have been other films where this has been the case, where it's been like, oh no, my job was to be like a
homewrecker.
Yeah. My job was basically to wreck the home with full consent of one of the parties. You know, the wife was like, yeah, no, sleep with him so I can take photos of it and have proof. So it's just like, okay, all right. Yeah,
but see, the interesting thing is that this is what's even weirder about this, and I'm like hung up on this plot point, because it was the men that were paying her. I guess maybe the women didn't have money, right? Because like back in the day, the wives would have been like stay-at-home wives, because women didn't really work back then, right? Back in the 30s. But so maybe even it was the women who were like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Was it the women who were saying, fine, go ahead and do this so we could divorce? Or was it the men saying, I just want a divorce from this bag at home or like whatever, right? So I don't know.
Yeah. It's definitely possible. I mean, if the husbands are doing it, saying, listen. I mean, it might even mean to say, it's like, listen, let's frame it. I will pay you to testify that, yes, we had an affair or that sort of thing. Because then it means they get out of a loveless, you know, relationship, they can go marry whoever they'd like. I don't know what alimony's situation was like in the 30s, if it was like a major thing, or if it was like, cool, I'll give you a little stipend, you know, you'll go back and live with your parents or whatever, you'll get remarried, divorce. I think it was more of a common thing. I won't say it's like common as it is like today, you know, a third of marriages end in divorce common, but I think it was happening because we've had a few of them recently in Hitchcock films.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a thing. Who knows? It's just, it's such an odd position.
Yes.
Oh.
My career of choice is homewrecker. Like,
I know. If you had like little cards? She'd be like, so what do you do? I am a homewrecker for hire. Yeah. Because if I got a card with that, I presume, like, not even joking, I would presume that it was like a construction company.
Oh yeah, like,
a home wrecker, like just come, yeah, and it's like a cute name. And she's like, no, you pay me, I will destroy your marriage.
So basically, she's Miley Cyrus.
Oh,
a wrecking ball.
I know. It's just when you said it, I just started singing it in my head. I was like, this is such a catchy song. Don't sing it, Chris. Don't.
Okay, well, let's move on to the other interesting topic. So basically what's going on, and the reason for this whole setup, like we've been kind of circumnavigating the plot of this film here. So this Mr. Hornblower has recently bought some property from the Hillcrests. And the condition of the sale was that the people who were renting property there would be allowed to stay there. And so Hornblower comes in and kicks them out after he buys it, doesn't keep his word. And so this is kind of what starts the feud and makes them upset. Now, Hornblower is slowly buying up property around the Hillcrests, and he's bought in property basically all around. However, there's this new piece of property that's come up for auction, and this is the last piece that will basically completely surround them, and it will block off the view that they have, this nice view, if they start building like factories and stuff, which is their goal. So we get this really cool scene where they're in the auction and the camera's going back and forth, And Mr. Hillcrest ends up buying it. They've got a he's got an agent that helps him to buy it at the end, and which is a really interesting twist. But at the end, the Hillcrests use this information of Chloe, this scandalous information, in order to get Hornblower to sell the property back to them at a discounted price, on the condition that they never say anything about it. So one of the interesting plots that I want to talk about is this idea of, like, rich people and keeping their word, yet they don't keep their word.
Mm.
You know, like, because that's a really big thing. And they're, like, stipulating. He's like, look, I don't trust you, so you better put your hand on the Bible.
Yeah.
And swear to God that you're not going to tell anybody. You know, and it's interesting. And I just, I don't know that I have much to say on it, but I wanted to address it because it happens twice in the film, right? Yeah. Where this they're expected to keep their word and they don't.
Well, it's a bit of an irony, and it does reflect something in British history, which you might not be aware of, the Magna Carta. So
I don't know what that is.
No,
I don't know much on history.
Oh, no, listen, that's fine. So the Magna Carta was effectively a series of laws and protections drawn up in, like, the 11th, 12th century, and it basically said that kind of lords and fiefdoms and all the, you know, if a lord had like an area to cover and people lived on that, he couldn't then blackmail or sell their houses or that sort of thing. They had a right to them. So it was basically protecting the workers and all that sort of thing. So okay. Hearing that and, you know, hearing you recap and everything, it did kind of strike me that it's kind of a betrayal of one of the most important principles of kind of British history, and it is a very British film. It was kind of funny to me because I hear accent very similar to mine pop up throughout, and it's the first time really in a Hitchcock movie, because normally everyone speaks in very proper plummy Queen's English. It's all very much like, oh yes, and that sort of thing. So it was kind of an interesting thing, but this whole idea of the rich bending the rules is something I think is very kind of timely, if nothing else. You know, we're hearing pretty much every week of, you know, this celebrity is hiding all their money in a tax haven so they don't have to pay any tax. And, you know, for example, in the UK, we're suffering a bit of a crisis money-wise in our National Health Service, because I'm not really sure what it's like in Canada in terms of healthcare. Do you have free healthcare, or is it cheap?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We have free healthcare, yeah. There's certain services that you do have to pay for, but it's very limited in what you do have to pay for. Okay. Most of it is free, yeah.
Yeah. So it's effectively the same with the NHS in the UK. A vast, vast majority of it is free, funded by the taxpayer, all that sort of thing. You can go private if you want, but yeah, it will cost you money. But it really struck me when we're talking about kind of like the betrayal, that sort of thing, when there's, you know, people saying, oh, well, hiding money in offshore, you know, celebrities doing it, there's, you know, expenses scandals, and, you know, God knows what's happening in America at the moment with the, you know, the one percenters and everything. And I think it's a very timely just kind of sentiment that, you know, these poor people who, you know, get their homes bought out and they're evicted, and it happens right from under them.
Yeah.
It is really sad. And in, it's sort of, that's, it's the destruction of both houses. And in a way, it also kind of ties into a bit of, like, the Romeo and Juliet, the kind of, the warring families, and the fact that, you know, the two lovers caught at the centre of this end up destroyed by kind of lies and secrecy. But it's the families as well who are left after, you know, when the dust settles, who, you know, you've got that, like I said, that last final speech of, you know, you have completely destroyed my family. If I ever have a chance to get back at you, I will take it. And I just think that's such a dark thing to end on. But it's true, there is a lot of resentment, particularly at, you know, the posh and the rich, because of the fact that their money is seen as inherited to them. That the only reason they have it is by virtue of being born into the right family at the right time, you know, sometimes the right gender or that sort of thing. That's it. So I get both sides of it, because what, you know, the Hillcrest and the Oh my god, what's the other family called? It's just falling right on my brain.
Hornblower.
Hornblower, that's it. Thank you. You know, I also get the anger towards the Hornblowers because they are coming up and it's the kind of the new greed. And, you know, not showing any consideration because they were former working class and yet they're treating people who are working class, the people who live on the land he provides, and evicting them. Mm-hmm. That is treating them just as badly. So it's kind of a lack of respect on all sides. And it's So it's... Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead, finish.
I was just going to say, so it's an uncomfortable truth of a film, but I think it is one that is sadly still quite relevant today.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And, you know, there is one other little tag scene, which is even just as traumatic and, like, heart-wrenching. So at the beginning, so Hornblower is evicting these people from the property, and the old man and the old woman come to visit the Hillcrests, and they say, look, this is what's going on. Can you help us? And they're like, well, yeah, this is part of the agreement in that he wouldn't sell the property out from underneath you. You're supposed to stay there. That's the agreement. So this whole thing is brought on by this family coming back to the Hillcrests and asking for help to be able to stay on that property.
Yeah.
And at the end, after all this tragedy, you know, the Hillcrests get their property back and everything like this, and this couple, this old couple, comes back to them and says to them, thank you so much for letting us stay there. And after they leave, the Daddy Hillcrest is like, I completely forgot about them. I completely forgot they existed. And so, like, at some point, he wasn't even fighting for these people anymore that he made a promise to. He was just fighting, and there was tragedy just for the sake of fighting and tragedy. And I'm just like, what? That scene was just like, oh my, oh. Mm. And, you know, like, when I watched this movie, you know, I started it last night. I was very tired, so I watched about half an hour, and I finished it this morning. And I enjoyed it. I did. There was nothing wrong with the movie. It was not a plot, though, that I was like, okay, this is a movie I'm going to rewatch because it's, you know, it's just like people fighting over land. Like, okay, I've seen it. I don't know if I've ever seen it. But talking about it with you, my opinion of this film is really elevating upon thought and discussion. And maybe it's simply the writing, and maybe it's simply the play, because this is dismissed as a very lesser Hitchcock work, like to the point where there's a line about it, where like it doesn't even deserve barely any mention in these Hitchcock complete works books. Mm. They don't even talk about it. But talking about it, like, there's a lot to say in this movie.
Yeah, I completely agree. In that I watched it a couple of weeks ago, then I rewatched it tonight in preparation. And it isn't one that I'll remember it, but I won't be like, oh yeah, it's really enjoyable, it's really that. But kind of the discussion of it makes it worthwhile. And it's kind of the fact that, like I said, it is really relatable. And because, you know, of like the stuff you mentioned, that tag scene where it becomes clear that rather than fighting for, you know, his tenants effectively, he just wanted to fight against, you know, the other guy.
The Hornblowers, yeah.
Against, like, the Hornblowers, yeah.
And they lost sight of what they were fighting for. They were just fighting to fight. It's,
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, I mentioned Romeo and Juliet. It is the same thing. You know, Capulets and Montagues started fighting, you know, generations ago, and they don't remember what for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the other way they're even to be brought back together is with a mutual tragedy. And in this case, I think it's the opposite. It's two families who started fighting, and they've had this dark shared tragedy now in the death of Chloe, which both of them are culpable for at this stage. And it's just, you know, it's left unresolved and angry and sad, and it just, it's a very dark ending. It's probably one of the darkest endings I've seen a Hitchcock do yet.
Yeah, because I think it is too.
Well, it's dark, but it doesn't even come with, like, resolution. Yeah. It's very purposefully, like, a lot of unsaid and a lot of unfinished, you know. We don't see justice, or we don't see kind of, like, a resolution. It's just a sad ending of a chapter.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there was nothing in this that really stood out as Hitchcock to me, but I mean, I enjoyed it. It was good. Like, I would give this, you know, if we're going to give this one of our ratings, I would give this, you know, probably 3 out of 5, you know, arguments with your rich friends.
Yeah. I will go with 3 out of 5 unconscious, because in, you know, she is alive in the play. I will say 3 out of 5 unconscious daughter-in-laws pulled out of ponds.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's our little review here on The Skin Game. So, excellent. Thanks again to Tom and Pat for their little segment. Well, that's our review of The Skin Game, and I hope you enjoyed it. We had a lot of fun discussing it. I think we had more fun discussing it than watching it. It's a good movie. It's not a great movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something I'll go to again anytime soon, but I'm glad I've seen it again. And we're available on the Fandom Podcast Network's master feed, as well as our own independent feed. Please check out our t-shirts on tpublic.com there. Thanks so much to Norman Lau from the Fandom Podcast Network for designing our new show art. And thank you so much to our good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our awesome new theme song. You can find him at jasoncullimore.com. You can find him on SoundCloud at Jason-Cullimore and on Instagram at Jason Cullimore Artist. It's wonderful music. He's got some great stuff. You should definitely check out his work. And if you're in the mood for some more Hitchcock discussing, please don't forget to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine and their show Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they're covering all of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents half-hour episodes, and that's a lot of fun. So with their show and our show, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's career and his work. But I think that's all we've got tonight. Did I miss anything else, Chris? Is that it?
I don't think
We should. Where do we find us? Hey, Chris, where do they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @Hire_boy, where I'm basically just talking about random bits and pieces and the podcasts I am very lucky to be appearing on. I am currently, I have a sister podcast, not necessarily to this, but I have another podcast called North by Nerdwest. It's me and one of my best mates, Emma Platt, and we catch up on all kind of nerdy, geeky goodness. So please feel free to check that out on iTunes. Aside from that, I tend to pop up in a few different podcasts all over the place. I've recently been doing some work on Eccentric Earth, which is an amazing podcast by my friend Amy Walker, and it's a great chance for her to kind of explore all the weird, unusual stories of history, and there's some absolutely brilliant ones out there, so please feel free to check them out. I think that's about it.
And you can find our friend Tom on Twitter at TomCaldwell3000 and on Instagram at TheTomCaldwell. So be sure to check out pictures of his dog. You can find us on Facebook at Good Evening on Facebook. On Twitter, we're at Good Evening Pod. You can find me at Brandon Metella. I'm also available over on the Trek FM network with Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast, as well as over there, Melodic Treks has just been revived, which is the music podcast, so be sure to check that out. And I'll tease this, it's still a month away, but we're working on it right now. Next month in August, I believe it's August 19th, the first episode's going to come out on the Talk Film Society. My friend Zach Moore and I are going to be doing a short 11-part podcast on the Halloween films, and it's going to be called Halloween H4O. We've recorded the first episode already, but it's going to be a lot of fun. So,
I'm definitely checking that out. I didn't know you were doing that. I'm definitely checking that out.
Awesome, right on. Yeah, we are big Halloween fans, and we're looking forward to the new sequel. So, well, I guess that's all we got for you. Next time, be sure to check out Rich and Strange. That'll be the movie that we'll be covering. But until then, good evening.
Good evening.